Let me begin by thanking Rich and Mark for teaching in my absence. And I'm just hoping we can get more people to come when I'm off on the road. And so I'm going to recommend that we actually post who's teaching and what they're talking about, and not only put it on our Paradoxes website, but the website at reasons.org, because I heard really good things about the teaching that was going on here. So thank you, both of you gentlemen, for what you did. And appreciate that. I presume you all heard a report of the debate we did at the Orange County chapter. Okay, that's good. So, I'm really hoping that the LA chapter will be able to. I mean, it helps that they've got the president that they have. I'm trying to think of his name off the top. Virgil. Yeah, he's kind of got the charisma, and he doesn't mind just simply asking people to come. So maybe you can just take a page from his book and see if we can get things going here, because it seems like every one of their events is really a very good event. So if you didn't get to the debate, quite a few of you were there. I can see several faces of you. But I'll be teaching the joint heirs class the next 3 weeks, and that meets at 9:30 in the gymnasium. And I purposely set up that debate so that in preparing my presentation that it could stand alone. So basically what I'm going to do the next 3 weeks is simply give the content of the talk, not the debate so much, but the talk. So if you missed it, we'll be doing that. And give Virgil a few months, and we'll have a nice polished DVD of that debate event. So in the meantime, I've been corresponding with Tim Callahan. He keeps asking, where's all this documentation you're talking about? And even though I had it with me, he still wants me to, quote, do his homework for him. So I'm trying to help him find all the source literature that he was surprised even existed. So, pardon me?
You think it'll convert him?
Probably not. I mean, from what I can tell, he's looking for reasons not to believe. I mean, you probably notice he always picks the Bible translation that puts the Bible in the worst possible light and switches translations and also puts the worst possible interpretation on the passage that he picks. So, that's a big difference. You know, when I was going through the holy books of the religions of the world, my approach was, let me put the Quran in the best possible light and see how it stands up. It's always easy to critique something by putting it in the worst possible light. But put it in the best possible light. And if it doesn't stand up in the best possible light, then that can't be the Word of God. And so, approach the Bible the same way. So, while I was gone, I was speaking at a church in Blythe. And my wife told me no jokes about Blythe. So I avoided all those jokes. But the fun thing was, it was a relatively small church, and the people in the church gave the pastor a fund so that he could outfit his office. And instead of outfitting his office, he brought us out. And, it was really an exciting church in the sense I've never seen such strong support for our message as I had in that church. And the pastor literally teaches from our books, so it really made a difference. The next couple of weeks, I'll be going off to Birmingham and to Winnipeg, but I won't miss any Sundays. So, and I was at Tozer Seminary this past week. I'll be teaching a seminary course there in June, so I'll be gone a Sunday in June. They're going to have me teach 40 hours in 10 days. So, intensive course. The whole seminary is geared that way. All the courses are intensive. And it's designed so that people can take a week or two off and literally pick up a course. And so we're actually getting quite a good participation from pastors who get a study leave and other people take a week off work and take the course. So we'll be doing that. But the interesting thing was, on the flight up to Reading, there was this lady sitting beside me, and she had this book open. It was a textbook on Reformation theologians. So I said, "Are you a theologian?" She says, "Well, within a couple of weeks, I'll be getting my degree. And I'll be pastoring a church. And yes, I might teach some seminary courses." So we got talking. Wound up talking for the entire flight and then some. Turns out that she's one of these radical feminists. Believes the Bible's filled with errors and contradictions. Believes that the Pauline letters were not written by Paul because he claims that Paul was contradicting himself because of what he said about women and about homosexuals. She was also very much pro-gay lesbian lifestyle. So we had a debate, and it was, in one sense, more fun than the debate we had the day before with Tim Callahan. But the interesting thing, there was one of these small planes, so it was quiet, and everybody around us stopped what they were doing and listened into the debate. So, in fact, the couple behind me just said, this is the most entertaining flight we've ever taken. So, but what was fun for me is that the lady I was debating basically said, I've never heard this stuff before. And so she wanted my business card, and everybody around me wanted the business card, so... You never know what's going to happen on a flight. Yeah.
By this stuff, do you mean it was not the scientific content necessarily? Or, I mean, if you were talking about the social and moral issues, right?
Well, she was convinced that the New Testament especially was filled with... I mean, the whole debate got started. It says, well, you believe the Bible's without contradiction and error. How come the God of the Old Testament is wiping out whole communities and that never happens in the New Testament? Well, you've heard me respond to that. It's the whole idea of Jesus saying you'll be the salt of the earth. And with a baptism in the Holy Spirit, society changes. There are no examples of societal reprobation since the baptism in the Holy Spirit. And she had never heard that perspective before. And I said, well, let's just do a word study on the term sons of God. Notice that no human being is called a son of God until the day of Pentecost. And afterwards, all followers of God are only called sons of God. They're never referred to as children or sons of men or children of men. And so the same thing with the person of Jesus. Jesus only called himself the Son of Man, never the Son of God, until he rose bodily from the dead. And how in the epistles he only refers to himself as the Son of God, never the Son of Man. So don't you think the Bible's making a doctrinal point here? Well, she had never seen that before, so... Then she says, well, what do you do about Paul's writings where he says women can't teach and the places he says women can teach? And I says, well, I mean, you're a Greek scholar. Have you ever actually looked at the Greek words? And she really hadn't, so that got into an interesting discussion. And she says, you're really saying that Paul's letters are consistent without contradiction. And we kept on going on other things. And so then the lady behind me started asking questions, so interesting flight, so... yes, John. She wouldn't tell me which seminary she was attending, but she did say that she was being sponsored by a Presbyterian Church USA, and she's going to become the senior pastor of that church. So, but we'll see what happens. I mean, she says, you're giving me a lot to think about. I'm going to start reading this stuff. And, I just asked her a few questions about her seminary teaching. And, what's interesting is if you want to be prepared to teach these things, you really want to study people who have different viewpoints. And she had never been exposed to that. She'd only heard the liberal theological party line and never had really studied the rebuttals to that kind of a teaching, which is very different from what you get at a conservative seminary. They want you to know what the liberal theologians have to say, what the atheists have to say. They want to prepare you for the different viewpoints. Well, she was just not prepared. So, in that sense, I think she was grateful. She said, do you think it was an accident that we're sitting beside one another? So, it also had some credibility that I'd been a pastor for a few years because he says, oh, you're just one of these scientists. Oh. I says, oh, no, I do other things besides just the science. So, anyway... I've been telling you for a couple of years now that there's a research team that's been working on the nuclear DNA genome of Neanderthal. And just what a big deal this is, and I've written about this in both Creationist Science and More Than a Theory, that when this genome is published, it will provide a definitive test of competing creation evolution models. Well, what was published is what they call a draft of the Neanderthal genome. It's nothing like what they got for the mouse or the different bacteria. It's not a complete genome. They were able to come up with a rough draft for two-thirds of the Neanderthal genome. Nevertheless, this caused an amazing stir in the scientific community. And this came out just Friday. So May 7th, is you can see the date up there, is when this was published. And what you'll see in this issue of Science is two articles on the discovery and two commentaries. As far as I know, it's the first time that Science actually published not one but two independent commentaries on the article. The main article itself was 12 pages, and if you read Science, the longest that you typically see is 4 pages. What's more common is 2 or 3 pages. They allowed 12 whole pages for the main article, an unheard of amount of print. The commentaries themselves were 5 pages. The second article, by the way, was 4 pages. I mean, it's amazing what kind of print here. And then they released podcasts, and they released a video commenting on this discovery. And something that's completely unprecedented for Science, they released them all free to the public. They've never done that before. I mean, usually if you want to get the main article, you have to shell out $30. But they said, no, because of the importance of this discovery, we're making it all free immediately. Don't have to wait a year or two. It's all going to be available right away. So from at least the perspective of the Science editors, this is probably the biggest deal they've come across in several decades. Okay, what's the discovery all about? Well, it comes out of this cave in Croatia. It's the Vindija Cave, and here's a little photograph of the cave. That's the front side, and you'll look at what it looks like when you're inside. This is what it's like. There's a little guy standing here. So you can see it's quite a large cave. And this is a cave that's been inhabited by bears, Neanderthals, and humans over the past 50 to 100,000 years. Now, as they went into the cave, over the last several decades, they've been finding bones of bears and Neanderthals and human beings, and it's difficult to figure out who was eating whom. Or maybe they were just using it at different times. And, you know, the Yugoslavia area is filled with these limestone caves. And, you know, when the winter comes along, this is a nice place to shelter. So it's not surprising that these different species were sheltering there. And what got all a buzz was an analysis of these three bones. And these are three bone fragments from three different Neanderthal specimens. And this is really where they do their DNA analysis. I mean, what you want to do is get a fairly big bone, and then you drill into it and pull out a bone fragment and try to get DNA from that. The reason why you want a big bone is that if you've got material inside and it's buried efficiently, then that DNA will be protected from both bacteria and oxygen. Any other part of the skeleton, you're not going to be able to get any kind of DNA that's not so corroded that it's basically useless. As it is, there's quite a bit of corrosion in the DNA, and what they do is they take samples out of different portions, and then they try to look at a few sequences of 100 nucleotides each and basically try overlapping them and reconstructing the genome. Well, they've been working on this for years. And also, they've been running in. They did publish a report a little more than a year ago, and then they wound up withdrawing the report. And that's because there was human contamination. There was a big announcement that you know, there must have been considerable interbreeding between Neanderthals and the humans, but it was withdrawn because of the contamination. The whole point is, even if you wear gloves, there will be some of your DNA in the gloves, and when you touch the bone, that human DNA gets attached to that, gets into the sample, and so there's always issues with contamination, and that contamination still remains. However, in this particular case, they took great pains to minimize the contamination as best as they could, and so these bones were analyzed in a super clean room they built for the process. And how the humans go in there, they have to dress with special clothes. I think you know the procedure. But the other thing they did that was interesting is they made sure they were using female bones. And the reason why they wanted female bones is that they could check the DNA samples against the Y chromosomes of humans and Neanderthals. And that was a way of measuring the degree to which it was contaminated. So, but still, they referred to it as a draft sequence. They also pick bones that are relatively recent. And so one of the bones, I forget which one of these, dates to 38,000 years ago. The other one dates to 44,000. I think this is the 38,000 year one. That's 44,000. And this was found in a layer in between. They couldn't get a carbon-14 date on it at all. But because it was in a layer between the other two, they presume that it's between 38 and 44,000 years old. And they're referring to this as a draft sequence of the Neanderthal genome. It's a rough draft, and this is kind of a first report, and they're going to continue doing research on these Neanderthal bones with the hope that they'll be able to develop a progressively better and better draft. And so this is a first draft of two-thirds of the genome. Now, in the video interview and the podcast, different scientists were asking the leader of the team, Savante Paaba, if there's any chance that they'll actually ever be able to get a complete genome of the Neanderthal. And someone even asked, is it possible that we could resurrect the Neanderthal? In other words, if we actually get the DNA map that's an accurate DNA map, could we do the same thing to Neanderthal that people are trying to do with the woolly mammoth, taking the DNA of the woolly mammoth and actually using that to resurrect the woolly mammoth? Well, here's a quote from the leader of the research team. He says, we'll never have a finished sequence for the Neanderthal the way we have for a mouse. In fact, he points out we may never get past a draft of, say, two-thirds to three-quarters of the Neanderthal genome. And that's just because there's just too much corruption that goes on over the course of 40,000 years, even under the best of conditions. There's a reason why they go after caves. Caves are where you've got the best probability of preservation of the DNA, but even there, you're going to get significant corruption. Yes?
With the draft, how many X coverage is it?
Okay, this is about 3 to 4 billion nucleotides. So, yeah, it covers, I mean, it does cover about two-thirds of the entire genome.
But, usually they do a certain number of fold coverage.
Yeah, 1.3 is what they were claiming. So, it's not bad, but they're hoping to get more improvement, but Savante Paaba was quite clear there are limits. They simply aren't going to be able to do it with what they have with currently alive species. But what generated all the excitement was that they compared these three bones from three different female Neanderthals with five presently alive humans. And I'm trying to remember, they picked a Frenchman. They picked someone from West Africa. I got a list coming up in a minute. Someone from South Africa, a Han Chinese, and a Papua New Guinean. So those are the five they compared it with. And what they noticed is that they were finding parts of the Neanderthal nuclear genome that was consistent with parts of the of three of the humans, but not the other two. In other words, they were finding that they could, some of the Neanderthal DNA was the same as what you see in the Europeans and the Asians, but not the Africans, the sub-Saharan Africans. And this led to their speculation that maybe there was human Neanderthal interbreeding going on. So they compared the DNA of three female Neanderthals to five present-day humans. Here are the exact details. A French European, Han Chinese, Papua New Guinean, a San South African, that's a particular tribe in South Africa, and a Yoruba West African. Now, this is the one that caused the controversy. The Yoruba West African was quite discordant with other West African genomes by a large measure. And so probably the first thing they're going to do is try to sample other West Africans. Because that could reflect on their conclusion that there's something different about the Europeans and the Asians versus the sub-Saharans with respect to the Neanderthal genome. So, now, as background, the same research team has analyzed mitochondrial DNA in 20 Neanderthal specimens. And those specimens show that no inbreeding occurred between Neanderthals and the humans. But as the paper points out, nuclear DNA is more sensitive than mitochondrial DNA to a weak inbreeding signal. Now, what this analysis tells us is there couldn't have been significant inbreeding going on, but this analysis indicates there may have been a very low level of inbreeding taking place. So that's background as to what was actually occurring here. And they point out that the inbreeding is the most parsimonious explanation. Parsimonious in that you see this distinction in the DNA, and the Eurasian agrees with the Neanderthal, the African does not. That's the easiest and most parsimonious explanation with the fewest assumptions. But they also point out in the last paragraph of this 12-page paper, and so you kind of go through 11 and a half pages of the paper where they're expressing extreme confidence that interbreeding is the answer to the results, but in the last paragraph they say, here's an alternate explanation, namely that you've got incomplete genetic homogenization going on. Now what they're referring to is that the Europeans and the Asians may be interbreeding with one another much more efficiently than the sub-Saharan Africans do. And as they point out in that paper, we actually see this in sub-African peoples even to this day. Namely, they don't homogenize well. And that was certainly much more the case 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, than it is today. For example, when David Livingstone went into the Congo, the thing he noted is if you had these African tribes living side by side, where in one tribe they're all pygmies, 3.5 feet tall, and in a tribe just a couple of miles away, they're all giants over 7 feet in height. And so, you know, how do you, and so this is an example of the fact that they don't, you know, interbreed with their different tribes. Also explains the politics of the sub-Saharan nations. Notice how they always vote on tribal lines, and one tribe's in power, and then they wind up taking revenge on a competing tribe. Where that typically doesn't happen amongst the Europeans and the Asians. Okay, moving on. First of all, what I want to look at is what does this study imply if indeed the interbreeding was going on? If it is true, that means that the Europeans, Asians, and Pacific Islanders interbred, but not the sub-Saharan Africans. And that means that if this indeed is true, the interbreeding occurred before the Great Migrations, but not after. And what you see in Genesis chapter 10 is that there is a situation where all of humanity is in the Persian Gulf area, and then God steps in and forcibly scatters humanity rapidly over the face of the earth. And if this indeed is true, this interbreeding would have had to occur before that. In fact, there's something in the paper which suggests that this took place in the caves that's near Carmel in Israel. There's a set of caves there where they find both human bones and Neanderthal bones, and so there's some speculation. Maybe that's where the interbreeding took place, and then there's a scattering humanity, and it didn't occur thereafter, and then shortly thereafter the Neanderthals disappeared. Okay, if true, and this is not in the paper, but what is in the paper is that when you look at those parts of the genome where the Eurasians agree with the Neanderthal genome, but not the sub-Saharans, 3 out of the 6 genes that carry the multiple substitutions are for different skin properties, particularly the texture and the color of the skin, which raises the possibility that maybe this event explains the racial diversity that humans achieved early in their history. And it's something you see in the Genesis chapter 11, how there was one, all the peoples of the world were one people, one nation, one city, living in one region. And then God steps in, and what you see in Genesis 11, God forcibly scatters humanity in different parts of the earth, putting them in nations where each nation would have defensible borders, and at the same time, God imposed different languages. Now, it mentions nothing about racial diversity, but that's the one place, as I wrote in my book, The Genesis Question, where it would make the greatest sense for God to place racial diversity upon the human population. Because the reason for the different languages is to set up free market competition for citizens. Kind of like our own government, when it sees that there's a corporation that's too big to fail, what you do is the government steps in and breaks up that company. So there will be free market competition going on. Maybe we should be doing that today. Here's God stepping in and saying this, because the problem is if you go one nation over all the human population, it's too tempting for the leaders of that nation to oppress the citizens. But if you've got many different nations competing with one another for citizens, if you've got severe oppression in nation A, those citizens can leave and become part of a different nation. Now, for that to work, you need barriers between the nations that will prevent a single nation from simply dominating all the other nations. And so having appropriate geographical elements in place to give you defensible borders is one way to maintain independent nations. Another way is to have different languages. And the whole point there is you're going to think twice before you leave your nation, because you've got to learn a new language and you've got to cross that defensible border. But if the oppression is severe, you will pay the price. And so you want the language barriers to be high, but not too high. Not so high that you would say, I'm never going to learn this language, but not so low where people of a different language can step in and take over with relative ease. Well, likewise, you can see how racial diversity could play in to maintain these separate nations where they compete with one another for citizens. All in the context of what you see in Ezekiel, Daniel, and Revelation, which says at the time of the end, these barriers will disappear. And I think there's good evidence we're living in that time, because it's too easy to cross the geographical borders. We've got technology which can easily come across those borders. In fact, when our nation fights a war, they use the Navy and the Air Force, for which the barriers make no difference whatsoever. And now we've got mechanized armies that seem to be able to roll over any barrier at all. Look at the success we're having in Afghanistan, which has probably got the most defensible borders of any nation you can imagine. But they're really of no help when you've got high technology. And likewise, the language disappears every week. And language is much less of a barrier than it used to be. And especially in my own discipline of astronomy, it's no barrier at all. Every university in the world has their graduate students and professors teach their classes in English and converse in English and write in English. In fact, it was amusing to me when we spent some time with astronomy professors from Paris Observatory in France. And they spoke flawless English. And I said, you know, how did you guys learn such good English? He said, what's the only language we ever speak? In fact, we have problems just like you do going to the neighborhood grocery store because we can't speak French. And yet they live in France and they're native French speakers. But it makes the whole point that whereas 30 years ago I needed translators everywhere I went to speak, that's not the case anymore. People can understand the English. So language is no longer a barrier and race is no longer a barrier. Hence, because people are interbreeding. In fact, what's interesting about this research studies are pointing out this is the window of time that's fast closing on this kind of genetic research. Why? Because the human population is intermarrying across ethnic barriers at such a prolific rate that they argue that within a decade, this kind of research will no longer be possible because the human population will be just simply too homogenized. But that may be one reason why they're getting this African signal out, is because of all the human ethnic groups, they're the least homogenized, although there are a couple of exceptions amongst Europeans and Asians. In fact, what's interesting is Savante Paaba is a Finn, and the Finns are one of the least homogenized of the European populations. And so I was wondering, why did they pick a Frenchman? Because the French are very homogenized. They should have gone to Estonia or Finland. And why a Han Chinese? Likewise, they're very homogenized. Maybe let's go pick up a Japanese. Well, they're going to do that. They're realizing that they took a very small sample of presently alive humans. So in their next study, they're recommending that they're going to sample many more currently alive humans. But the point is they better hurry, because if they wait too long, there'll be way too much homogenization going on. Yes?
I actually wanted to ask a question about that, because presumably when you're comparing genomes, it's just bioinformatics. You have someone who has their genome sequence and you run a computer program and it compares them.
Mm-hmm.
And why did they compare to all the people who have their published genomes? Like, why did they only pick five? I mean...
Well, as they point out in the paper, this is preliminary. They've actually titled the paper Draft Genome Sequence for Neanderthal, and lots of disclaimers in the fact that this is a work in progress, but they felt it was of such importance, even though it's not finished and still very rough, they needed to get it out anyway. And I think it's a good idea because it's going to stimulate a lot of funding and the research towards this end. But yeah, so far they've only looked at five, although they did comparisons what they call a standard human genome, which is basically the one produced by Craig Venter, so they kept referring to that. So, but, you know, that's kind of a conglomerate rather than looking at individuals to really do what they want to do. They want to sample individuals. So, but that will be coming. Yes?
I've lived in southern France, and I've always thought that the characteristics of a lot of people there actually resemble picture that genome, you know, Neanderthal. So I think it's why not take a French sample? Because they do, if there's any interbreeding, it would have happened in southern France.
Well, yeah, and there was that issue, and they also felt the French were fairly representative, because basically what they were doing was taking one individual from every major class of ethnic groups, and they wanted it to be fairly representative. So on purpose, they picked groups that were fairly homogenized. But, you know, the researchers recognize they need to also pick those that are not homogenized in order to come up with a faithful conclusion. But this is just the initial work. They're going to be doing more. We'll see what happens. But no, the reason why I brought this up is one of the things we've been pondering with at Reasons to Believe is at what point and how did God step in to bring racial diversity? Because you see no mention of racial diversity in the book of Genesis. But by the time you get to the book of Exodus, it's speaking about racial distinctives very early in the book of Exodus. Somewhere between God creating Adam and Eve and what we see in the book of Exodus, God steps in to impose racial diversity, and maybe this is the answer as to how it happened. Now, I'll have more to say about that, because obviously this is also pointing out some sinful behavior on the part of humans, but the Bible also addresses that, particularly in Genesis and Leviticus, so we'll get to that. But this could be exactly how God pulled off the racial diversity. And doing it just before the rapid scattering would mean that the racial diversity would be preserved. So I like the fact that this is consistent with the timing that you want. Because what the evidence is telling us is that if this interbreeding did take place, it was just before the rapid scattering of humanity over the face of the earth, which would put it right in the context of Genesis 11. So anyway, moving on. Oh, by the way, when the Bible talks about these barriers breaking down in the last days, that's also the context of the nations no longer competing with one another for citizens, and that leading to the governments of the world beginning to oppress citizens like they did in the days of old. So that's what you all got to look forward to. All right, moving on. The other thing they noted is that if this is really true, it may account for the incidence of these diseases that we're seeing in the human population. Because if they looked at the genes that are responsible, they notice that it correlated with type 2 diabetes, Down syndrome, autism, and schizophrenia. And so when Leviticus talks about, we need to change the way we engage in our sexual mores in order that we not inherit the diseases of the Egyptians, this may have a lot to do with it. Okay. Also, if true, what was really clear by the researchers is that the interbreeding occurred at a very low level. Such a low level that they conclude there must have been a very strong cultural taboo on humans having sexual intercourse with animals. And of course you see that in the Bible. It's not just in the Bible, it's a taboo you see in every culture. that there's certain things that people agree on when it comes to sexual mores, that you not have sex with your children, that you not have sex with small children, even if you're not related to them, and not with animals. So that's a taboo everywhere. But they said, yes, it must have been a taboo that was equally strong in those days, because this was happening at a very low level, just as low as it would be today. Now, the level, they also noted, is so low that it can't have any impact on human biology or the human soul and spirit. Now, when I was sharing this with our staff philosopher, Ken Samples, he says, Hugh, how is this going to affect the image of God, the doctrine of the image of God? He says it doesn't affect it at all, because the interbreeding is at such an extremely low level that it doesn't affect the biology. And one thing that came up in the paper is that if this actually did bring about a biological impact, how do you explain the fact that Europeans of all the different ethnic groups seem to be the least adapted to living in a cold climate? I mean, Europeans typically do live in cold climates, but it's because they have clothing. And but in terms of their actual body function, they're not as well adapted to the cold as other ethnic groups are. They're horribly adapted to the cold, for that matter. So if there was a biological link, because Neanderthals were beautifully adapted to the cold, but apparently none of that ever kept in to the human species. As they looked at the impact of genes, none of it impacts the basic biology of the human being, and none of it impacts the genes that control the hardware interface between the soul and the spirit. Okay, how does this impact the creation-evolution debate? Now, I say this because on Friday, I noticed the Young Earth Creationist websites were filled with glee over how this proves their model, because in their model, Neanderthals are fully human. And therefore, they're saying this proves that if they were interbreeding, then they're part of the human race. And Adam and Eve gave rise to both humans and Neanderthals, is their position. They would also claim that Adam and Eve is the progenitor of the Homo erectus. So they're all excited putting out all their articles, which was somewhat amusing and disturbing to both Fuzz and me, because when you read the paper, it really doesn't help the Young Earth Creationist cause at all. It actually refutes the Young Earth Creationist cause, because what it demonstrates is that the Neanderthal genome, when compared to the human genome, is distinct. What they basically were proving is, just like with the mitochondrial DNA, the nuclear DNA establishes that Neanderthals are not human. Their genome is distinct. Now, before I take any questions, that's also true of the morphology. The morphology is distinct. And probably the biggest distinctive of the Neanderthal, besides the fact that they got a barrel-shaped body and short limbs, is how well adapted their oral and nasal structure was for breathing in cold air. Neanderthals have an enormous sinus cavity, which allows them to breathe cold air in and warm it up before it gets to their lungs, unlike us human beings, where we have to wear a parka in order to warm that air up before it gets into our lungs. I'm going to be going to Winnipeg shortly. It still has snow there. Snow doesn't melt until the middle of June there. But fortunately, I'm not going there in January. If I were to go there in January, I would have to wear one of these special parkas to warm up the air. Otherwise, it would freeze my lungs, and that would not be good. But none of that morphology shows up in human beings. So in terms of their bone structure, their body structure, radically different from humans, likewise the genome, and therefore what this paper does, rather than support the Young Earth paradigm, it refutes it. Now, yeah.
So Hugh, if this is true, they try to say what percentage of human beings alive today have some Neanderthal DNA in them?
Well, the researchers are very careful to try to alleviate that alarm that some woman might be married to a Neanderthal. So, and what they're pointing out is it only takes a very tiny amount of inbreeding to get a weak signal into the genome. But what they were pointing on the paper, it has no impact on any of the significant features that make us human, and no impact on the distinctives between humans and Neanderthals.
But it may account for the racial diversity, you're saying, thing, and that we all are members of some race.
Well, for example, probably every one of us in this room has a little bit of DNA we got from Genghis Khan. Here's one guy running around the country or the continents, and he managed to spread, and see, he didn't impregnate that many women, but it was such that the DNA in modern human beings, almost all of us have a little bit of that DNA, but it doesn't make me Chinese. The DNA I got from, or any of you got from Genghis Khan, is of such a tiny amount, it really doesn't have any significant impact on your characteristics. Likewise, the same situation here. And we talk about racial diversity, I'm saying it's still a maybe. And keep in mind that the signal that they were getting in terms of how much of the Neanderthal genome they could see in the Europeans and the Asians and not the, the sub-Saharan Africans was like at a 1 to 4% level. And the contamination level, they estimate, was 0.75%. But as I read the paper, it says you can tell this is written by biologists because all they did is they quote the one sigma error bar. Now, in physics, we don't believe a result until it's 5 sigma removed. And that would mean that the 5 sigma error is actually greater than the claimed impact, which is why the paper concluded saying this is the most obvious explanation, but it's not the only possible explanation. So the jury is still out. And the fact is, when you look at the researchers, none of them are sub-Saharan Africans. They're all Europeans and Asians. But we don't know. The paper didn't reveal who was handling the samples, but they did make a big point that they did everything they could to minimize the contamination. And as I read the paper, they really did. That's what made the experiment so elegant. It's just the caution they went to avoid contamination. But they're also clear that there was contamination. It's there. And the claimed effect is just a factor of 3 or 4 more than the 1 sigma error. So that's why they said rough draft and preliminary conclusion. But the problem is all the blogs that you see are writing as if this is a done deal. It might be. And so, I'm giving you this report saying it's got interest for our creation model no matter which way it goes. But there's a possibility this could play in. Possibility. I'm not saying a probability. Yes. Well, one of the things the paper points out is that we have other examples of this kind of interbreeding in the animal kingdom. Probably the best example is the wolfen. And a wolfen is a creature that's the result of a dolphin and one of these dwarf killer whales interbreeding. And they're actually fertile, so they can reproduce. It's not like the donkey and the horse where it produces a mule and the mule is infertile. In the case of the wolfen, it actually is fertile. However, that wolf, you don't see wolfens running around. They're exceptions because as that creature continues interbreeding, it either goes the way of the whale or it goes the way of the dolphin and it quickly disappears. Nevertheless, if you were to sample DNA of whales and dolphins, you'll see a weak signal indicating that a very low level of interbreeding took place. But in terms of, looking at a dolphin and looking at a whale, you're not going to see any biological signature of that interbreeding. So it's a similar example. So if that thing can happen with whales and dolphins, or say, why can't it happen between a human and a non-human creature? As what the Bible means, reproducing after its own kind, I think about 6 months ago, I did a little Bible study on what that Hebrew word means. It's the word min, M-I-N. And, in terms of the higher animals, the Bible defines it as having rather narrow descriptions because it mentions 8 different species of owls as being separate min. So I would define it narrowly, but it's reproduced after its own kind. And so we don't see wolfens running around. They're exceptions. Occasionally you will see it happening in the wild. More commonly you see it in marinas where they force the mating to take place, kind of like what we do with donkeys and horses. But it actually does happen in the wild, and it is because their DNA is so closely related. And that's one thing they did point out, is that the DNA of Neanderthals and the DNA of humans is remarkably close. On the other hand, there's sufficient distinctives that it's clear that Neanderthal is a separate species. They're not human. So this is of actually making the young Earth model worse than it was before the discovery. Yes?
Okay, you mentioned earlier that we tend to get more well-preserved samples in caves, but we probably won't get better than two-thirds or three-fourths series. I'm wondering if you were to find one frozen, would that make any difference?
Yes, it would.
Is that a likely thing? I mean, there were a lot of Neanderthal activity in the northern
Yes, although what we notice is that Neanderthals didn't get into the really cold places. I mean, here they are, the best adapted primate for the cold, but they don't penetrate as cold a region as we humans do. We're about the worst adapted for the cold of all the big primates. In fact, we are. We are the worst adapted for the cold. But, you know, because of our technology, our clothing enables us to go there. So when they say Neanderthals penetrated Siberia, I wish I provided a map here. I've got a map elsewhere on my computer where I actually show you the range of the Neanderthals. Southern Siberia only. They did not go into northern Siberia. And as far as Europe goes, the farthest north they got was France. We don't see any evidence in England. We don't see any evidence in northern Germany. So in terms of the cold parts of Europe and the cold parts of Siberia, they didn't go there. But neither did they go very far south. So if you were to look at a map of Europe and Asia, it's basically a narrow swath across the middle of Siberia. And we do notice it coming south. For example, there's some evidence that Neanderthals lived in those caves in Carmel, Israel. But apparently only when there was an ice age driving ice down. So during the ice age, the Neanderthals moved south. So then they moved into Spain, Italy, and Israel. But when the ice ages were gone, then they would go back up north a little bit. So evidently, this is one of the evidences, they didn't wear clothes, because they were very careful to stay in a very select climate zone.
And the second part is, now you're saying that because the genome is contaminated with so many blendings of racial background, is there a way that they could get samples from maybe a generation or two earlier that maybe even have
ways? That can be done. Okay, the reason why they went after genomes of people that are alive, you get the least corruption of the genome. What you can do is dig up people that have been dead for 10,000 years. And that's been done. I think the oldest they've gotten is 35,000 years for a human being. But now you're getting some corruption in the genome.
But even like 500 years, I
think. Yes. No, that's an obvious next step to do. And the other good thing about doing that is it enables you to measure the mutation rate. Now, as it is, this report contains a couple of pages that talk about the mutation rate. I'll be getting there in a minute. But there was one more question. Yes, in the back.
The time period that they found it, is that the time period in the Bible when?
Yes, that's one thing. I mean, I'm going to be ending here saying that there's actually evidence that more strongly supports what the scientific literature calls the Garden of Eden hypothesis. So what this analysis does is confirm the timing of the events that we see in the Bible. Okay.
Does the paper address at all whether about ancestry? Are we related to Neanderthal in any way? How far back is a presumed common ancestry, that kind of thing?
They do talk about the common ancestry of Neanderthals and humans. I'm getting to that right now, because my next segment is to say also there's been a lot of blogs put up by theistic evolutionary sites saying this proves our model, that humans and Neanderthals are closely related and evolution is happening. Well, actually, the paper comes up with 6 points saying just the opposite of that. And so I find it ironic, all these blogs are coming out from young earth creationists, theistic evolutionists. If you actually read the paper, it's not good news for either model. And they spend quite a bit, and by the way, the paper is written from a strongly theistic, from an evolutionary perspective. Not theistic, of course, just plain atheistic naturalism. And the whole paper is based on the assumption that all life is related through a phylogenetic tree. And so, but one of the things they do note is that this study shows that very few apparent mutations take place for either humans or Neanderthals. So they were showing a very low mutation rate for both species. And then they tried to come up from an evolutionary perspective with a date for the common ancestor that gave rise to Neanderthals and humans, but they come up with four different dates, and you can see how discordant they are. That basically tells you the model's in trouble, since the different techniques give you radically different dates between 270,000 and 850,000 years ago. And all they're really doing trying to get this date is they presume that chimpanzees and humans and Neanderthals had a common ancestor between 5 and 8 million years ago. So they use that date, they look at the genome similarity between Neanderthals and humans, and they come up with this date. But depending how you do the analysis, you get discordant dates. But it's all based on the assumption that there's a common ancestor that gave rise to both chimpanzees, Neanderthals, and humans some several million years ago.
This common ancestor is, quote unquote, the missing link you're still looking for, right?
Well, the missing link is... No, they don't have a species, but this is all presumption. Okay, I'm running out of time. Let me kind of whip you through the rest of this. They found only 78 evolutionary substitutions during the last 300,000 years based on an evolutionary model. And the researchers pointed out this is way too low for their evolutionary model. And the other thing is they threw in one Neanderthal for comparison that was 70,000 years old as opposed to 40,000 years old. And they looked at the genome of that Neanderthal and compared it with the 3,000 or 40,000 years ago. They couldn't see a difference, which means over 30,000 years, they can't measure any evolutionary change there. And therefore, the naturalistic and theistic evolutionary predictions, rather than being verified, are falsified. And how the analysis confirms the Garden of Eden hypothesis. The last page of the paper makes note of the fact that this adds additional weight of evidence that the human species started off with a single pair or a very low population that lived in one region, stayed in that region for a period of time, then rapidly spread over the face of the earth, and then stopped migrating. I mean, that's kind of the great mystery that comes out of this DNA analysis. It documents the human species was in one place, then rapidly scattered, then stopped migrating. And so the analysis was, well, maybe humans are just compulsive migrators. But the whole point is we're compulsive migrators for only a short window of time, the same window of time that you see in Genesis chapter 10 and 11, and then we stopped migrating. And that's something you would not anticipate from an evolutionary perspective. Now, give me a couple of minutes. I've got 3 minutes left. I might go a couple of minutes over here. But I really want to address, and maybe I need to slip this into next week, is that this problem of interbreeding was anticipated in the Bible. And so a lot of people got upset that if this is really true, what does it say about biblical doctrine and biblical theology? Well, if it is true, I'm not saying it is true, but if it is true, it would fit right in this sense that it says in Genesis 6:4 that the Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. Now, there's a lot of debate over who are the sons of God and who are the daughters of men being referred to here and who are the Nephilim. The Nephilim we're actually studying in our text in Psalm 139. The Nephilim are none other than the giants of old, the Anakim, the Raphaim. Goliath, whom David slew, was one of the Nephilim. And as we're pointing out, one of the contexts for this Psalm of David is that's the time when God raised up David's 30 mighty men, and one of the purposes for that raising up was to rid the earth of the last of the Nephilim. But notice what it's saying here. It's saying here that bestiality at the level of the human species is possible. And now, exactly who are these sons of God? I actually went into this in a debate with the female theologian on the airplane, saying, let's look up this term. Well, what you discover is sons of God in the Hebrew can refer to human beings or to human beings. But it only refers to humans who have been baptized in the Holy Spirit. And nowhere in the Old Testament are humans called sons of God. What you will see is a prophecy in Hosea, which is a message to the Jews that they will become sons of God. But it's a prophecy of what will happen to them in the future. It's not what can happen to them right now. And then you got this interesting verse in Jude 6, where it says, angels who did not keep their positions of authority, but abandoned their own home, these he has kept in darkness, bound with everlasting chains. Now, if you look at this phrase in the Greek, it's the same phrase you would use for bestiality. So one of the points I made in the Genesis question is, a possible interpretation of who these sons of God are is that they're demons. They're fallen angels who left their positions of authority, abandoned their own home, came down to earth, and as it says in Genesis 6:3, they looked upon the daughters of men, saw that they were beautiful, and then chose them for wives, and that gave rise to the Nephilim. And what do we see about the Nephilim? They all had birth defects. They were supernaturally tall. They were only males, no females that we see mentioned. And God saw that this was a pernicious enough situation, he needed to rid them from the face of the earth. And then we have this verse in Leviticus 18. That's the chapter where it talks about sexual mores, and it says, do not have sexual relations with an animal and defile yourself with it. A woman must not present herself to an animal to have sexual relations with it. That is a perversion. Well, a number of scholars looked at this passage and say, you know, in order to justify that being the Bible, there's got to be some risk with having sex with an animal. Now, one risk that we may be dealing with today is AIDS. There's research indicating that it was bestiality that led to the AIDS virus invading the human population. So just for disease purposes. But there may be more to it than that. And so, in that sense, interbreeding of humans with another species is not ruled out by the Bible. We're actually warned to avoid doing that very thing. I'll pick that up again next week because I'm out of time. But this may be one of the more potent things that comes out of this research. What it says about our interpretation of Genesis 11, 1 to 9, where we have God creating these different nations, and then what it says about this perversion of having sex with animals. And notice, again, this is something that's considered perverse in all cultures, all ethnic groups around the world. Okay, with that, let me close in prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for this breakthrough research that was done and published just a couple of days ago. And Father, we thank you, too, for all the buzz and excitement about this research. And Father, I pray that you would properly equip us to talk to people about this and use it as a way to guide them into your truth. And Father, may we appreciate too that this is just the beginning. More research is coming, more opportunities to test the different creation evolution positions out there and also to test our own position. Father, I pray as a result of this ongoing research, we'd be able to get a sharper, more clear, and a true picture of what you're trying to teach us about creation and the history of life on planet Earth. And Father, I pray too that you would give us greater wisdom and grace in using this as a tool to share with people who don't yet know you as Lord and Savior the truth claims of the Bible. In Jesus' name, amen.